And the ritual is you take the mask off. I guess that's the way that worked. Thank you. I can breathe. You know, Philip kind of implied that I'm going to go a long time, didn't he? He said something about the chock full of information and all that. And he could have spent a lot of time on all this material and all that. That's possible that will happen. I hope not too badly. So, as is always the case, usually when you come among brethren, you find connections that go back a long time. For me, you know, I can go back really 60 years, the memory of the Coleman family, 45 years probably, the Franklin family, when I worked in a hard job just down the street in the school that's just down the road here all summer long. Probably 40 years ago, the Warner family, the connections there. More lately, the Westbrook family has a connection with mine. I won't go into all these details. And that's wonderful to have those memories. But I'll tell you, meeting men who are even fairly new converts or new elders or struggling in new areas of the life, and aren't we all, right? Just married, just have kids out of the house. We're all exploring new territory and sharing very briefly. And I've just enjoyed just in almost sometimes brief conversations, but with various men, John and Kip and Aaron and Glenn and others, that I've had a chance just to get to know where they are. Where did they come from? What's important in their lives right now? And instantly, because we're disciples of Christ, there are things in common, struggles that are the same, lessons that we've learned in common. And that's to me the most rewarding thing, is to have those new acquaintances, not just to remember the old ones that are there. So, you might guess that at the end of a weekend on leadership, successful leadership, I would have the crescendo and finish, right? The culmination, the crowning, what's it called, the capstone lesson for that. So I feel obligated to entitle this lesson, The Secret of Effective Leadership, and it'll be, for everyone, I hope will be valuable. I actually teach courses on, not anymore, I'm retired, but I did teach courses at Georgia Tech on leadership occasionally. And that's, of course, corporate leadership. Or military leadership or something. And so there's something already not quite appropriate about that, but we feel obligated in those courses to define leadership. It's a class exercise. Hey, everybody, what's a leader? You know, that kind of thing. You've probably been in situations like that. And there are some classical definitions, like appealing to what is uniquely human in us to cause us to strive together to meet a challenge. And some people add, to do things we wouldn't like to do, but we learn to like them because the leader helps us see that. I'm not opposed to those definitions, but they're really related to earthly thinking. Some of it correct, some of it not. There are more brief explanations of leadership, such as anyone who has followers is a leader. I think about that with moms and others. Yeah, sure. Somebody's watching me and looking at me as an example, then I'm a leader in that sense. There are others say just someone who has influence. That's right. But I don't like that. Right? Looking up in the dictionary, English dictionary, I think there may be better ways. So a typical sermon on leadership, you know, would take out a concordance and look up leader in the Bible, right? And that's an interesting exercise. If you get kind of zoned out here on the lesson, get out your phone and do a search on the Bible, and you'll find the term is used about 160 times in the Bible, mostly in the Old Testament, and maybe only 4 times in the New Testament. And I'll give you this hint. The 4 uses in the New Testament are not about good people, right? It's usually the leaders of the Jews who crucified Jesus. Or, here's one, blind leaders of the blind. You remember that phrase? Not a very favorable reference to leaders. But you know, and we've sung about it this morning, and I was pleased about He's My King, My Glorious King, as we led off the service. Where do we look for our examples for everything, really? And we kind of got to this yesterday. Who is the chief shepherd, if you're thinking about being an elder, right? Who is the ideal father, if you'd like to be a father? Who is the real pattern of husband being head of the wife? It's Christ in the church. You see, that's the place to go for that. And so let's stop messing around with human definitions, and let's look at the example of our King. And so I would like to go to Psalm 110. Psalm 110 is messianic, without doubt. In fact, this psalm is quoted more than any other psalm in New Testament writers. And you'll recognize even some of the language. There's no doubt this is a picture
of the King Jesus. The Lord says to my Lord, sit it, and you can remember the instance in Jesus' life where these came up, but look at the psalm. Look what it's saying. The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. The Lord sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter. That's a symbol of power and leadership. Rule in the midst of your enemies. Now, is that the picture of leadership? And you know, I want you to know, if you weren't here yesterday, and even if you were, you probably didn't understand what I was trying to say, but I'll just explain it again. Men have a kind of a nature, a little different from women, that we like to kind of fight and win and take a challenge and do scary things and accomplish those things, right? I'm not going to argue with you about that. I'm just going to assert that for this morning. And this kind of feeds into that, right? Let's win. Let's rule. Let's be winners, right? And we try to figure out, no, is God asking us to be effeminate and kind? You know, is that what he's asking us to do? Or is he asking us to take that disposition, that temperament, right? That desire, which he put within us, I believe. He created within men and direct it toward the right things. You see the question there? Look at the very next verse, and you see how this fits together. But your people, I put the word but in there, but do you see the difference? He's describing the enemies of the Lord. That's our battle, is against the forces of evil, Satan in particular. But that's not the way we lead our people, nor is it the way Jesus led his people. Do you see that in this verse? But your people, does he have to smash them? By the way, read on in Psalm 10, and you'll see a lot of violent things going on that God executes on his enemies. Is that what we're supposed to do as leaders? No. But look here, there's a secret. It's a secret. I'm going to tell you what it is. The secret of effective leadership. It's right there. You see what it is? Your people, offer themselves freely on the day of your power and in holy garments. We've talked about this a lot of times. You know, the husband's only real power to enforce some kind of headship, and I don't even think enforce applies. I don't think it's the right word. It's when his wife submits. What is the elder's power? Do they wield pistols and shoot you if you don't obey their, if you don't submit to them? No, it's your willing submission to them. Actually, what is God's power over us in the moment? Lightning bolts when we sin, or is it just that we offer our, that's what this is about, offer themselves freely. Look closely, you'll also see a little bit of almost like a ceremonial sacrificial reference in that term. An offering. A free will offering is really the kind of the words. You could rearrange them a different way. Those were things offered under the Old Testament in the Old Testament as a sacrifice, a kind of a religious ritual. I want to focus in on that phrase, your people will offer themselves freely. It's found only maybe two or three other times in the Old Testament. One is very interesting to me, and that is that when Nehemiah, a leader of the people, right, came back to Jerusalem, and he was trying to build up the city, populate it, and some of the leaders lived in Jerusalem for that purpose. But, you know, they couldn't just be there by themselves. They needed some helpers to work under them in the city of Jerusalem. The leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem. The rest of the people cast lots to bring 1 out of 10 to live in Jerusalem, the holy city, while 9 out of 10 remained in their other towns. I presume that means in their inherited lands, on their, you know, on their property to work and so on. And the people blessed all the men who willingly offered to live in Jerusalem. There's that same phrase again. Now, I don't know if you were unlucky or lucky to be chosen. I have an idea that it was the unlucky ones, right? The 1 out of 10 that had to go live in Jerusalem and not be at home on their farms. But they sacrificed and they made that offering. And that's how the leadership of Nehemiah was carried out. The people offered themselves willingly. There's one other place, and I'm going to spend more time on this one, and that is in the book of Judges. And you can go ahead and be turning to Judges 4 and 5. Because in chapter 5, in the Song of Deborah and Barak, there is a recounting of this great victory that was won at that time. And it begins this way. When leaders lead in Israel, and I think that's a theme, by the way, of the story of Deborah and Barak. There was a lack of leadership. I'll point to some things in the text that suggest that the men were not doing their jobs, right? I mean, Barak in particular, but maybe in other ways. The men were, and do you know, we talked about this yesterday. I forget who brought it up. But it's, do you know what happens when there's a vacuum of leadership or a vacuum of spirituality in the men? Guess who steps in to fill that gap? In some ways, I think more spiritually qualified people, and that's the women, have to do that. And I think you see that in the story of Deborah. And throughout the four, chapters 4 and 5, 4 is the history, 5 is the poem, song that covers the same event. You see in that a lot of examples of men doing what, well, I should say it this way, men not doing what they're supposed to do and women doing it for them, right? Who ends up killing the guy in the end of the story, if you remember that? We'll get to that. But anyway, just think about that as an overarching theme. But here in Judges chapter 5, the poem of Deborah begins, "When leaders lead." And that's a difficult Hebrew term to translate. It could mean when the locks are flowing, locks of hair, strangely enough. But the reason for that is, you know, locks of hair are associated with strength in the Old Testament. You can think of Samson right away, but others too, Absalom and others. When that power gets unleashed of leadership, right, into the world, then all kinds of good things happen. I think that's the way this poem is beginning, when leaders lead. But I think Deborah immediately says, here's what happens. Here's the way it works. The people willingly offer themselves. Look down in verse, I think it's 9. It's not just the common people. Verse 9, "My heart is with the rulers of Israel who offered themselves willingly with the people." Clearly a theme in this is the willing offering of people to follow. That's the secret of successful leadership. I'm finished with the sermon. I guess I'll have to preach another one. And this sermon is entitled, "What Does It Mean When People Offer Themselves Willingly?" And that's for all of us, okay? And I think we can use the story here in Judges 4 and 5, which I don't know, if you kids like this, I've noticed you have your Bible periods up in the classrooms. This is period 8, I think it is, the Judges. One of the great books, if you like stories and dramas and everything. It's one of the most confusing books if you like to have good guys and bad guys clearly delineated, right? But anyway, it's an interesting book, and there's lots of connections to Israel's history throughout in that. So let's talk about that. Here's the story. Let's start in chapter 4 of Judges very quickly and get the background. Ehud was dead, chapter 4 of Judges, verse 1. The children of Israel, again, did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And you know, the reference to Ehud, and actually Shamgar is mentioned in the previous verse, and later in the Song of Deborah, Shamgar comes up. I think the reference to those two, Lone Ranger, you know, special ops guys, you know, solo guys, you know, Shamgar with his ox goat. I picture him jumping out of the trees, you know, by himself, but over time killing, you know, a bunch of Philistines. And Ehud with his homemade dagger and all that. Those guys are gone. These great heroes, Lone Ranger types, are not around anymore. Worse than that, Israel has again fallen into apostasy. They did evil in the sight of the Lord. Chapter 5 in Deborah's song, verse 8, it says that they chose new gods. And that's just their typical behavior after a period of time. And so, the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army, that is Jabin's army, was Sisera, who dwelt in Harosheth Hagoyim, which is, I think, Hebrew for peoples, Gentiles. It was a place. I don't know what Harosheth means, but Harosheth of the peoples, the Gentiles, in the land of Canaan. Remember, Canaanites were the ones they were supposed to have driven out. It's one thing to be oppressed by the Assyrians or something, but these were the people that lived in the land. And I'll just tell you a little tidbit about that. If you go back 100 years to the time of Joshua's conquest, Joshua attacked the city of Hazor, where Jabin was. In fact, the ancestor of Jabin was called Jabin, same name. And he not only conquered it, he burned the city to the ground. So 100 years before, that city was gone. And now here it is back again and actually dominating the entire land. Of course, with the help of Sisera and his chariot. Got to be frustrating, right? And it was worse than that. There was kind of like 20 years of domination in which the Israelites just had no chance militarily. Notice that it says in verse 3, the children of Israel cried out, for Jabin had 900 chariots of iron. This was the transition, as I understand it, from the Bronze to the Iron Age. I don't fully understand the science here. I guess you could heat furnaces up hotter, but I do know that iron is probably better than bronze for building stuff, especially weapons, swords, chariots, and other things, right? And it's clear that the Israelites had a huge disadvantage in that regard. You may remember the judges that we already have talked about, and even in the future, Samson and others, the strange weapons they had to use, right? Ox goads and homemade daggers and jawbones of donkeys, of all things, and pitchers and torches and trumpets is all they had. And by the time of Saul and Jonathan, they went to attack the Philistines. There was no sword found in Israel. Only Jonathan and Saul had one. And it turns out that the Israelites couldn't even sharpen their metal farm instruments without going down to the Philistines and paying them to sharpen their tools. So militarily, this is not a good situation for Israel. But turn this the other direction. He had 900 chariots of iron. And that seems to be emphasized throughout the whole text. You can kind of look ahead. Every time Sisera is mentioned, look at verse 7. Jabin's army with his chariots and his multitude. Verse 13 of chapter 4, Sisera gathered together all his chariots. How many? 900 chariots of iron, right? It's mentioned again. 15, Sisera and all his chariots and all his army. Barak pursued the chariots, verse 16. And even at the end of Deborah's song, Barak and Deborah's song, she imagines that Sisera's mom is home waiting for her son to come in. And how does she ever know that he's pulling in the driveway if she hears the jingle jangle of the chariots when he drives in? That's the way she described it. And of course, poor Jabin's mom waits and waits, and he never returns because, of course, he had been killed in the battle. So a huge military disadvantage. And really, in a lot of ways, that military disadvantage had been reflected in the society. And I'll show you some things on the map, and we'll make that point here. So how can I do this? This will work here. So there's Hazor. You see, it's up in the north. It's actually in the tribe of Naphtali. You see that that's what that arrow means there. This is the tribe of Naphtali, which, by the way, is Barak's tribe. I'll just mention that. Keep that in mind. But you see, this is the valley of Jezreel, and along this, the Kishon River is right here. Plays into the story. And this is the Carmel Range. Haifa is the modern city there, but then there's a mountain range. It's pretty tall. I guess Eden climbed Stone Mountain yesterday. It's about twice as tall as Stone Mountain if you stand in the Jezreel Valley and look up, and it goes up pretty steep in a lot of places, right? So that's what that mountain range looked like. But way down here in Ephraim is Deborah's tree she sat under, judging Israel. Right, so remember all that. But of course, this area was the place where you travel. It's where trade would take place, and so on. And so this axis that went from probably Harosheth Hagoyim is probably somewhere along the Carmel Range. That axis just inhibited all commerce in Israel. People couldn't go anywhere. They had to sneak around by the byways, is what the song actually says. Some other places of importance. We mentioned Harosheth Hagoyim there, Naphtali, Deborah's court, and then Mount Tabor. And this triangle got a little bigger in the chart here, but it's actually across the valley here, kind of all by itself, like a little conical thing out in the middle of the pyramid. I think I have a picture of it later. But that's the geography, and that's the point I would make. So I mentioned commerce and social life was suppressed because of that domination. And there was little national unity at all. And I think that's part of the implication of Deborah saying there's no leaders. Nobody to step up to anything. And I get the picture, too, that the spiritual situation was pretty poor. Not just that they were after other gods, but Deborah was there, I think in an extremely feminine way, waiting for people to come up and ask her questions. And she was inspired. She was a prophetess of the Lord. They would come and ask her questions, and she would give them advice on that. Okay, so that's kind of where we were. Let's talk briefly about the battle. What happens is that Deborah calls Barak to service. Chapter 4, verse 6. She sent and called for Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kedesh in Naphtali. and said to him, "Has not the Lord God of Israel commanded, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor and take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and the sons of Zebulun," which is the other tribe next to it on the west. Do you sense in that, she like sends him a message. Do you sense a little bit of a rebuke in that? I don't know, written things don't have a tone of voice, but has not God called you? At a minimum, this is not her tribe that's in trouble. It's Hazor up in the area of Naphtali. These Canaanites are supposed to be conquered. That's what God told them to do. And Barak, a leader apparently of some kind maybe in that tribe, had not done a thing. He was sitting there and she says, get off the ground and get going and call some men together. And here's my instructions to you. Now, she didn't jump up and become the Joan of Arc leader of the thing. She said, you gather the men and get ready for battle against Sisera, the captain of Jabin's army. That's what you're going to do. And notice his response. Yes, ma'am. Thank you. I was meaning to do that. But that's not exactly what he says. He says, well, I'll go only if you go. Now, I don't think that was a very courageous response, and I presume that she wasn't too impressed with it either. She said, because you said that, the woman will get the glory for killing the guy. You remember the story. I hope you remember all this. But see it in the light of that. She is pushing him to do what he was supposed to be doing, and he seems reluctant. I'll mention just a detail, which to me it's fun, it maybe is a little bit expressive. If you look at the Hebrew writer who mentions these judges, for time will tell to, I always say that, time will fail to tell of, right? And he lists these, Gideon and Barak, Samson and Jephthah, David and Samuel, and the prophets, that's the list. But all six of those have been kind of reversed in order, in pairs, right? Because Gideon and Barak, that's a reverse order. Samson and Jephthah, no, it's Jephthah and Samson in the book. And David and Samuel, no, it's Samuel and David in the story, right? So why is he doing that pairing of them together? And that is, I think that Gideon and Barak have something in common. They were doubters. They worried. They needed signs. They needed somebody to get them to go, right? God says, if you're afraid, then go down to the camp of the Midianites. And he goes down to the camp of the Midianites, right? So because I think he is frightened by that. And so I think we see Gideon and Barak together as those who have to overcome doubts. But he does call the Israelites together, and they came to Tabor. And this is a picture of Tabor. Not the clearest one, but you can kind of see the idea. It's just out there by itself. And you see what's in the foreground here is the plains. And guess what operates well in the plains? In fact, go back to chapter 1 of Judges. It says that the people of Judah, they conquered the mountains, no problem, but they couldn't take the valleys and plains. Why? Because the inhabitants had chariots of iron. Right? Well, that's what's happening here. So if you're going to fight a battle, where are you going to fight? Well, if you're Jabin, it's in the plain, right? If you're the Israelites, it's in the mountains. And so they gather in the mountain. But think about it. I don't know. There's no sense of real scale there. But can you imagine gathering 10,000 men to that mountain in secret? I don't know. Maybe it had a lot of trees in those days, but I don't think so. I mean, for one thing, they probably didn't all come on this very same day in the same few hours. They probably, trickled in over time from various places. There was no secret. And as soon as they started to do that, Sisera heard about it. Let's see, where is that? It mentions that, verse 12. They reported to Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinadab, had gone up to Mount Tabor. So Sisera gathered all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron. Did I mention those, right? And you understand chariots are like tanks. They have horses, which, by the way, another weakness of Israel. You'll notice in the song there's a brief reference to donkeys. And in the Judges, remember there was a judge that rode on donkeys. And by the time we get to David, they've really progressed because he rode on a mule. It wasn't until Solomon's time, hundreds of years later, that they actually started, and against God's will, really, to gather, amass horses for military purposes. But still, horses and chariots of iron. And so I'm guessing there's a driver in the front that just runs over you if you're in the way, and there's a shooter in the back with arrows or spears or something that, takes care of you if you don't get run over. And that's what they were facing, 900 of them. So Sisera says, I'm ready. He comes out of his bat cave down in Harosheth HaGoyim, and he gathers there on the valley for this confrontation. with Barak and his troops. And I wonder, in some ways, what was Sisera thinking? Surely they're not going to come down into the valley. Surely they won't. They have more sense than that. On the other hand, it'd be fine with me if they do. We're ready. And I'm also wondering what the Israelites might have thought up on the mountain. Okay, now what? Now what? And I make this point on purpose, maybe for later, to say that, I'm supposed to turn this up, that God often gives us leaders that we are kind of like not all that impressed with. Can you imagine what you know of Barak? You know, does he seem like the most inspiring leader so far? No, as a matter of fact, even when it's time to go, of course, now he's dragged Deborah along with him. And to her credit, she goes to help, give him whatever kind of a comfort he needed. But she has to say, go, go. She's the one that tells him when to head down the hill. She doesn't lead the troops, but she says, now, this is when you do your work. And she tells him to go down into the valley, out of the mountain. You see how that doesn't seem like the best plan in the world. And I think it's often the case, as God's people, that we have leaders that we look at them and say, well, they're not the most charismatic people in the world. We talked about this a lot yesterday. We looked at all the roles that God had given his leaders throughout history, in Old Testament and New. Never, hardly ever do you find him saying, I want soldiers that can sling a stone with both hands and never miss. There were some, Benjamites could do that, right? I want people to judge that matters between the issue that Moses appointed under him, who are great lawyers and they understand the law and they're clever like Solomon, they know about dividing babies and all that. That's not what he said. I just want honest men whose heart is right. And David was selected not because he was as tall as Saul, right, but because his heart, which God sees, was right. Do you see that? That's what God is selecting leaders, which on the surface, as followers, we say, well, I don't know. That person's just not, he doesn't inspire me very much. Of course, I'm thinking worldly ways, right? Not only that, God's plans are not always the most intuitive, you might say. Right? I mean, this is the way the local church works. That's what we do with our money. That's the plan for worship. That's what you have to do to be saved. You know what I mean? There are things that God just asks us to do because we have faith, and he has maybe more wisdom than we have, and maybe we do that. And he maybe knows what's going to happen in the future more than we know. And so leaders who may not seem to be the most, on a worldly level, qualified, and plans that seem kind of strange. You see, that's what's happening in this story here. Barak, reluctant kind of guy. Deborah's kind of kicking him. And this plan to come zooming out of the Mount Tabor down into the plain against 900 chariots. How will this turn out at all? And so the time comes. And so, so Deborah says, go, go. And where's the verse? I like to look at it. Let's see. Did Deborah, verse 14, said to Barak, up, for this is the day the Lord has delivered Sisera in your hand. I like those past tense references to God's plan. It hadn't happened yet, but she talks like it has, and so on. So, and by the way, was it Barak that was going to conquer these armies? You see, throughout this, it basically says, verse 23, on that day, God subdued Jabin. See that? Even though we have a role, it's God working. It's his plan. And that kind of helps us, I think, be satisfied with leaders that may not be the most, you know, awe-inspiring in some ways, but they have a plan that's consistent with God's. The Lord routed Sisera. Verse 15, that's not a very complete description of the battle. And I'm curious to know how in the world could they win, you know, running down the hill there into the plain where the chariots are. And so they did, with his army, with the edge of the sword, and I presume they had to get the swords from the soldiers they were defeating. And Sisera, the leader, the commander of Jabin's army, he alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. That's puzzling. If you were in a race or trying to get away from somebody, I'd stay in my chariot and go as fast as I could, but something else was wrong. Barak pursued the chariots and his army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim. See, they were going back to the Bat Cave. And all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword not a man was left. How in the world did all that happen? It just doesn't seem like it would be possible. And yet, if you look in chapter 5, you begin to see what actually happened. If you read, starting with verse 4 of chapter 5, now this is in song, so there's some, you know, couplets and all. Lord, when you went out from Seir, I believe that's a mountain range to the east, when you marched from the field of Edom, the earth trembled and the heavens poured, the clouds also poured water, the mountains gushed before the Lord, this Sinai before the Lord God of Israel. You remember Sinai. What happened at Sinai? Clouds and smoke and earthquake even, shaking earth and so on. You kind of sense what's happening here. Deborah's describing in song. Look at verse 19. The kings came and fought. The kings of Canaan fought in Taanach by the waters of Megiddo. They took no spoils of silver. They fought from heaven. The stars from their courses fought against Sisera. The torrent of Kishon swept them away. That ancient torrent, the torrent of Kishon, oh my soul, march on in his strength. Then the horse's hoofs pounded, the galloping of his steeds. And I think you see in that poetic language what actually happened. A big storm came up, a lightning and thunderstorm, a violent one that shook the earth and scared the horses and flooded the area and caused the Kishon River, which is a creek, by the way, if you ever see it. But it's occasionally overflowed, even in modern times. To overflow its banks and fill that wonderfully hard ground on the plain with water and make it mud. And guess what happens to chariots and horses and everything when they're in the deep mud? They're in trouble. And that's why Sisera would jump out of his chariot and run away. You see, all the story fits together. Now, who is responsible for that? You see, God had the victory. And he had a plan. And as silly as it seemed to go running down that mountain, that's exactly what they were. That's the best thing to do. And so Barak and the Israelites were able to do that because of their faith in God. Sisera escaped. He heads north. The troops are headed back, you know, to the... They're headed back this way, to the west, to Harosheth Hagoyim. But he goes northeast to get to Hazor, I think. But he stops off because he's tired in the tent of Jael, who is the wife of Heber, who is a Kenite, and that's a long story. They appeared as early as Abraham. They're related to Jethro. They appear later on in the book of Jeremiah as they're co-inhabitants of the land with Israel, though they don't believe they own it, and so they dwell in tents. That's the way they demonstrate that. But they're godly people, more godly than the Israelites, it turns out, if you read Jeremiah 5. But anyway, there they are. He gets to her tent, and she welcomes him in, asks for water, gives him milk, gets him sleepy, covers him up, and then drives a tent peg through his head. And that's a kind of a violent picture, isn't it? Of what? And guess who is getting the glory then for this? Is a woman, just as God had said, doing what really a man's job would be, it seems to me, in that way. So that's part of the story there. All right, what can we learn about how to offer ourselves willingly? And so that was a long introduction, but now I have a three-point sermon, and we'll be done. Okay, so I have 3 points here to make. Number one is when our leaders, and remember, they may not look as spectacular as worldly leaders, right? Among God's people. They may not be the people that are the most charismatic, energetic, intelligent, all those other things, but they're godly men. And when they have a plan, I think we need to show up. Look carefully at what Deborah says in her poem here. I say Deborah, it says it's the poem of both of them, but I just picture this as her voice. Because she says, when I, a mother in Israel, arose, she talks about her, you know, her role as a mother, not a queen, not a military leader, but as a mother helping us do what we're supposed to do, which is what mothers do. Anyway, I think of it as her poem. But look down to the very last two lines in verse 15. Among the divisions of Reuben, you remember that was that Transjordan tribe down in the southern area, there were great resolves of heart. Why did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the pipings for the flocks? The divisions of Reuben had great searchings of heart. But they didn't come. Is it possible that when there's a plan made, some activity that the church is involved in, that the family wants to do, and we just don't show up. I don't think this is going to work. Oh, there's searchings of heart, meaning that we thought about it. It was hard. We had a lot of stuff going on. I feel kind of bad about not doing it, but we didn't show up. Right. That's what Reuben was doing. It isn't that Reuben didn't know about it. It wasn't that they were not able to contribute. They just said, we ain't doing it. And I think it caused some consternation, some guilt maybe, even in their own heart. There was great searching of heart. I think sometimes we kind of play around at our religion. We play around at being in submission to the elders and say, well, okay, but they're asking us. They want us to jump in with our whole heart. Well, yeah, yeah. And, you know, we almost torture ourselves, but we end up not coming. Searchings of heart, but we don't participate. Let's keep reading. Gilead. Now, that's probably, Transjordan, part of Gad there on the eastern side of Jordan. Gilead stayed beyond the Jordan. Why did Dan, now Dan's up on the seashore, Mediterranean. Why did Dan remain on the ships? Asher continued at the seashore and stayed by his inlets. Not evident that they actually had great searchings of heart, but they knew about it. And Deborah says, why didn't they come? Well, you know why. Ships require a lot of work. Ships have to be maintained. You just can't go off and leave your ships. I mean, we all have jobs. A man's got to make a living. We just can't go and abandon these great, important business deals that we're engaged in. We got to maintain our ships and stay home and keep the home fires burning and all that kind of thing. We're with you. Hope y'all do well, right? But we're busy people, so we can't show up. Look at verse 23, maybe more frightening. Curse Meroz, said the angel. Angel of the Lord. Curse its inhabitants bitterly because they did not come to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the mighty. I don't know. We don't know what Meroz, maybe probably a town. We don't know where it was. Maybe that's the curse that it just disappeared. But it's cursed, not just criticized, by an angel. The suggestion is that Meroz was a city up close to Hazor, and had formed an alliance, perhaps, with Jabin. And when they were asked, as Israelites, hey, come help us fight Jabin's army, you know what they kind of were stuck with, right? Well, that would be awkward. And you know, when we've made alliances with evil, and we're asked to do something on a spiritual basis, it makes it hard for us, because we have alliances already. We maybe are already in a kind of a, what's the word I'm trying to think of? Traitorous situation. And so we struggle. We're conflicted about helping with that spiritual. That can be a deep problem. I could give maybe a perfect personal example. Maybe your marriage is in shambles and someone says, hey, could you come teach a class on marriage and family for us or something like that? See what I mean? That's just an example of how those conflicts would be in trouble and create that difficulty. So Meroz, among others. So that's the first point. Show up. But the second thing is, because you might say, well, I can't really offer anything. I'm not a soldier. I don't have any experience and so on. But look what else. Bring what you have. Let's keep reading from this poem here. Verse 14 in chapter 5 of Judges. From Ephraim, Ephraim was a powerful tribe. You remember the oldest son of Joseph? That's actually where Joshua was Ephraim, right? He was a leader. Militarily, it's where Jeroboam, who eventually rebelled against Judah, was from. Very powerful tribe, right in the center. From Ephraim were those whose roots were in Amalek, meaning were roots against Amalek. Remember, the Amalekites had attacked the Israelites shortly after the Israelites crossed the Red Sea, and they had to fight them off. You may remember this part of the story, right? Remember that? Well, the Amalekites, the Ephraimites, apparently had a key role in that battle. And so their roots were in military success. And even more than them, after you, Benjamin, with your people. And if you want to study a fun thing, kids really like this. Benjamites, all left-handed. Not all, but predominantly left-handed. They could fight with both hands. You find that throughout. They were warlike. That's Ehud, for example, with his left hand, you know, pulled out the sword and did his tricky thing. Just a warlike tribe. And you understand at the end of the book of Judges, the small tribe of Benjamin almost defeats the entire nation, right? and almost was wiped out themselves, but a very warlike tribe. That's who I want in the battle, right? They're the special ops forces. They're the Army Rangers. I want them there, right? Okay, so that's good. Benjamin, you can look at Chronicles about that. Maker is an area probably in the tribe of Manasseh, but look what it says there. The rulers or lawgivers came down, and from Zebulun, those who bear the recruiter's staff. Actually, the literal translation, if you look at Young's literal translation or others, it says the writing instruments. The writing instruments. I'm imagining those guys up on Mount Tabor in the darkness before the dawn, you know, when they have to go fight the battle. And there's the Benjamites. You know what I mean? They're getting ready. And the Ephraimites, they know what to do. And they look over, and they're these like administrators and people with writing quills. You know what I mean? And they're saying, what? Who invited those guys? What are they going to do? But you know they came, and they're praised by Deborah for coming. And it may be that in the confusion of the battle, someone who could write and carry a message or keep track of where the dead and the living were, or very useful talent perhaps, and a lawgiver, administrator who could organize people and get... Do you see that? Let's not say they aren't useful. They came and they brought what they had. I think that's a wonderful story. Issachar just says, we don't know much more about it, except they went down to the battle at Barak's feet. Wherever he's going, I'm going there, right? That's what I'm going to do. But I think, and then of course Zebulun and Naphtali risked their life. But Jael takes the cake. Again, this is a story about women taking over when men don't do what they're supposed to do, right? You know, if you dwell in tents, it's pretty much the case in that culture that the women would have charge for setting it up and maintaining the tent, just like maybe in more home, any other home situation. And I imagine that Jael had spent a good bit of her life getting that mallet out, right, and getting those stakes out and putting the tent up. And somebody, some knucklehead guy trips over it, she's got to go put that tent back up, you know, whatever. I'm making all this up, you know. But I'll tell you, she knew where the tent peg was, she knew where the hammer was, and she knew how to use it. She didn't have a sword or the traditional weapon of warfare, but when it came time to do what needed to be done, she did it with her tent peg and her hammer. Boy, how many, we might say, dragons have been slayed by wise spiritual women, maybe in a figurative way. In fact, it says of Jael in Deborah's poem, it says, blessed art thou among women. It's in the later part of the poem. Is that phrase familiar to you? Can you think of any other place in the Bible where that's... It's Mary. Only other place, only other woman is Mary, the mother of Jesus, says that about her. I don't know what to make of that point, but it's interesting. So, bring what you have. Let's go to the New Testament briefly. As each has received a gift, haven't we all got something? Use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. Whoever speaks as one who speaks oracles of God, whoever serves as one who serves by the strength that God supplies, in order that in everything God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. God is not asking us to be just robots that only do what He says and don't ever take any initiative or don't use our own creativity, our own skills to figure out how to best do what He's asked us to do. In fact, to me, there's more creativity in some ways in followership because you've got to take the goals that have been expressed and figure out how to get them done and use the energy and creativity to get that done. I don't know why our society has come down to believe somehow that there's some inferiority. Certainly Christ didn't perceive that as He submitted Himself to the Father. It's an important thing to do, and we can use what we have. And then maybe the big point, the number three point is, be a leader maker. Do you know what I mean by that? There are people who maybe need to step up to leadership and they may need to be encouraged to do that. She sent and called for Barak, the son of Abinadab from Kedesh and Naphtali, and said to him, has not the Lord God of Israel commanded, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor. She was a mother in Israel, and that's what mothers do. They tell their sons and their daughters, hey, you're capable of way more than this. You're capable of a lot. And I'm going to push you till you live up to my expectation. I think in a way only women and mothers can do. I'll tell you, when I was being considered the eldership, actually before that, really, I hadn't really thought, we talked about this yesterday, I hadn't really thought seriously to prepare well enough. But there were some ladies that came. I called them mothers in the church in Ember Hills. And they were literally mothers, but mothers in a broader sense. So, Marty, I'm looking at you, thinking about you being an elder, comma, but here are some things you need to work on. And guess who gave me the best advice about that? About how I came across in public, about how people felt uncomfortable sometimes when I, you know what I mean? I needed that. And none of the guys were going to say stuff like that. The mothers in Israel were the ones that made the leaders effective, not just by showing up and bringing what they had, but by pushing them into what they needed to do. I think that's a kind of a Bible pattern. We're not jealous when other people are appointed to this sacrificial role of leadership. We studied all about that yesterday, right? We're not jealous. We push them into that. We help them accomplish that. Look at these kind of leader makers. Lois and Eunice, you remember that? That fine young man, Timothy, a whole career as an evangelist under the tutoring and mentorship of Paul. There's another example, right? Paul selected and encouraged and trained him and challenged him with hard things to do. Left him in Ephesus against those, as a young man, against those false teachers, and says, you've got to stop them, you've got to answer them. And a lot of other things he asked him to do, which were quite challenging. That's what we need to be doing, is making leaders. Barnabas. Back up before Saul, Paul and Timothy, make Barnabas, who actually welcomed, through influenced the apostles to welcome Saul, the persecutor, into the church at Jerusalem. And later went off to Tarsus and got him and brought him to Antioch to fill that stable of excellent teachers that they had there in that Gentile Jew church in Antioch. All throughout the Bible, there are examples of leader makers. And you have to look at the master again, the primary leader, and all the personal care he gave to the 12. The training, the warning, the examples, the sacrifice, the washing of their feet, all those things that he did. Why? For their benefit, so they could be the leaders that they had to be to go into all the world and preach the gospel. I think another way to make a leader, besides just kicking somebody to do what they're supposed to do, is to say, you know, I will follow you. And that's kind of what Deborah says. Okay, I'm kind of nervous about this, Barak says. I don't know how this is going to work. And he said, would you go with me? He said, I will go with you. I'll accompany you. I'll help you, in fact. I wonder if Deborah wasn't a wonderful meteorologist. And she stood up on Mount Tabor and said, okay, about now, go. You know, I don't know. But she helped him by telling him what he should do and then helping him and going with him. This is what I want to say to all of us here. Yesterday in our class with the guys, we kind of challenged ourselves to do something different. I don't know if that came across, I don't know if it's successful or not, but I began by saying, if I don't make a difference in your life somehow, that's our goal, is to be different, to do or think something differently as a result of studying God's Word and His examples, His instructions. Now these men, they are not perfect, right? Some of them are even knuckleheads. And they might come up with some crazy ideas. They may not be perceived as the most charismatic and careful and thoughtful and intelligent and brilliant and foresightful people that you've ever known in your whole life, but you're married to them. Or they're your dad, or they're the elder, or they're the preacher, or whatever. They might come up with some ideas that you think, I don't know. I'm suggesting you make a leader by following. Isn't that where we began? What is the secret of successful leadership? The people offer themselves willingly. And it may seem like a sacrifice. It probably should be a sacrifice. So I'm telling you, after our session yesterday, we challenged each other, first of all, saying how stupid and, you know, toxic masculine we all kind of tend to be sometimes, and how can we overcome that? Or more importantly, how can we redirect it to God's purposes, right? And I end by saying today that as men have to try to be leaders in God's sense of leadership, not the world's, not at all like the world's, we make them leaders, right? By pushing them, to take over their jobs, and then following, offering ourselves willingly when they do try to lead. Now, this is like a little narrow picture, a small earthly picture of, I think, what's going on kind of at an eternal level. Can you make the analogy to say that here we are and God is asking to be our leader? Can we make him our leader? How do we do that? Well, back to where we started again, Psalm 119 describes that great King Jesus who reigns. He conquers his enemies without mercy. But his people, we offer ourselves willingly in the larger sense. And I wonder if some of these roles on earth, of fathers, husbands, elders, other forms, even maybe governments, are there to kind of help us try a little bit to see what God is asking us to do, to submit to him in trust. Although, what a perfect leader he is. And he does have that power and intelligence and foresight and all that definite leadership planning that we wish we could accomplish on earth. He has that. So the question is, are you washed in the blood? Are you offering yourself willingly to the great King that we read about in Psalm 119? And we'll ask you to respond to that privately in your heart if you need to make changes in something you know the King is asking you to do, or maybe publicly if you've never given yourself in obedience to him through baptism and had your sins washed away in response to his commands, really, his leadership. Anyway, if you need to do something, come forward as we stand and sing.